Chapter 2 in the Yoga of Integral Knowledge, the status of knowledge. So this was first published in January, 15th of January, 1916. We know from our archivists at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram that this second chapter was significantly revised in its first four paragraphs. Thematically, they are similar, but he restructured the language. So, talking about the status of knowledge, obviously, how does one know? You'll find it interesting, I think, that the section in the Arya, the next chapter in the Arya after the synthesis of yoga, was the ninth in the series on the Kena Upanishad, focusing on knowledge, on mind, etc. So there are allusions within this chapter to what he would be writing about or was writing about in the Kena. So, as always, I beg for your indulgence as we dip into the Upanishads, because Sri Aurobindo prefers that reservoir of Indian wisdom to the later philosophic schools to find out what is knowledge with a capital K, what is gnosis, illumination. So, chapter 2, the status of knowledge. The self, the divine, the supreme reality, the all, the transcendent. The one in all these aspects is then the object of yogic knowledge. Atman, Brahman, exhibiting itself as all the many varieties of worlds, waking, dreaming, submerged, merged in a supreme superconscience, a transcendent. All of this is simply the one. All these aspects form an integral knowledge. One must know the divine in all of these poises. He uses the term divine again because it connotes both the personal and the impersonal aspects, which to his experience and to the experience of Sri Ramakrishna was the same reality. They are not different. Ordinary objects, the external appearances of life and matter, the psychology of our thoughts and actions, the perception of the forces of the apparent world, can be part of this knowledge, but only insofar as it is part of the manifestation of the One. It becomes at once evident that the knowledge for which yoga strives must be different from what men ordinarily understand by the word. Knowledge to us, the measurement of things which are before our senses, which skirt our mental consciousness, which appear in our emotions, these things, even the deep knowledge and the categorization of them into their various parts, amounts to nothing more than a description of the superficies of existence, what is on the surface. This Indian philosophy would call apara vidya. This is the lower knowledge. So what we esteem is not that. For we mean, ordinarily, by knowledge, an intellectual appreciation of the facts of life, mind, and matter, and the laws that govern them. The word appreciation is interesting from the Latin appreciare, to price. Appreciate then means to value justly. So it's an appreciation is the act of setting a value. This is a knowledge founded upon our sense perception and upon reasoning from our sense perceptions. And it is undertaken partly for the pure satisfaction of the intellect, partly for practical efficiency and the added power which knowledge gives in managing our lives and the lives of others, in utilizing for human ends the overt or secret forces of nature, and in helping or hurting, in saving and ennobling, or in oppressing and destroying our fellow men. Yoga, indeed, is commensurate with all life and can include all these subjects and objects. All life is yoga, the theme, the closing words of the first chapter of the Synthesis of Yoga. There is even a yoga which can be used for self-indulgence as well as for self-conquest, for hurting others as well as for their salvation. He's referring, of course, to the tantric practice of yoga, where self-indulgence leads to enjoyment or possession, which would be bhukti, and then release from all being mukti. Bhukti stemming from bhoga. But all life includes not only, not even mainly, life as humanity now leads it. It envisages, rather, and regards as its one true object a higher, truly conscious existence, which our half-conscious humanity does not yet possess and can only arrive at by a self-exceeding spiritual ascension. Conscious existent. That, again, is chit shakti. The chit, the great consciousness, differentiating, offers the distinction between knowledge, the knower and the known, and shakti, the one force that dominates all existence, becomes the many-aspected power displayed in the cosmos. Let's read the footnote. Yoga develops power. It develops it even when we do not desire or consciously aim at it. And power is always a double-edged weapon which can be used to hurt or destroy as well as to help and save. Be it also noted that all destruction is not evil. Other things may have changed. The first four paragraphs may have been revised. This note is the original note. All destruction is not evil. Shiva must often come to destroy, to restore an auspicious pace, an auspicious space in which growth can occur. Durga must come annually, one would say, to put down darkness and division and restore light and unity. Destruction is not destruction to the inner essence of that form which is destroyed, but merely an invitation, a stern invitation to better development and future growth. It is this greater consciousness and higher existence which is the peculiar and appropriate object of yogic discipline. So Sri Aurobindo's suggestion here is that until we have arrived at the pinnacles of being which are conscious, we have not arrived at anything like a summit. Anything like a conclusion has not been attained. We must somehow embrace the high and the low, unite the spirit to matter in order to integrate all modes of being here and now, ihaiva. This greater consciousness, chit, this higher existence, sat, are not an enlightened or illumined mentality supported by a greater dynamic energy or supporting a purer moral life and character. Their superiority to the ordinary human consciousness is not in degree, but in kind and essence. There is a change, not merely of the surface or instrumental manner of our being, but of its very foundation and dynamic principle. Yogic knowledge seeks to enter into a secret consciousness beyond mind, which is only occultly here, concealed at the basis of all existence. So, if we look at the Mundaka Upanishad, for instance, the third chapter, the second section, the third verse, it says, this self is not won by exegesis, not by brain power, nor by much learning of scripture, only by him whom it chooses can it be won. To him, this self unveils its own body. This self cannot be won by any who is without strength, nor with error in the seeking, nor by an ascesis without the true mark. But when a man of knowledge strives by these means, his self enters into Brahman, his abiding place. Attaining to him, seers, glad with fullness of knowledge, perfected in the self, all passions cast from them, tranquilized, these, the wise, come to the all-pervading from every side, and uniting themselves with him, enter utterly the all. Doers of ascesis, tapasya, who have made sure of the aim of the whole knowledge, the integrated knowledge of Vedanta, the end of the Vedas, the Upanishads, the inner being purified by the yoga of renunciation, not identifying with any form, not claiming any form, all in the hour of their last end, passing beyond death, are released into the worlds of the Brahman. For it is that consciousness alone, Sri Aurobindo writes, that truly knows. And only by its possession can we possess God and rightly know the world and its real nature and secret forces. All this world, visible or sensible to us, and all that too in it that is not visible, is merely the phenomenal expression of something beyond the mind and the senses. The knowledge which the senses and intellectual reasoning from the data of the senses can bring us is not true knowledge, sangjnana. It is a science of appearances, And even appearances cannot be properly known unless we know first the reality of which they are images. This reality is their self, and there is one self of all. When that is seized, all other things can then be known in their truth, and no longer as now, only in their appearance. So knowledge plumbs to the essence. And if we go back to the Kena Upanishad, because that's what Sri Aurobindo was writing about in the subsequent chapter to this in the Arya, it says in Kena part 1, fourth verse and on, that which is unexpressed by the word, that by which the word is expressed, know that to be the Brahman, and not this which men follow after here. That which thinks not by the mind, that by which the mind is thought, know that to be the Brahman, and not this which men follow after here. That which sees not with the eye, that by which one sees the eye's seeings, know that to be the Brahman, and not this which men follow after here. That which hears not with the ear, that by which the ear's hearing is heard, know that to be the Brahman, and not this which men follow after here. That which breathes not with the breath, that by which the life breath is led forward in its paths, know that to be the Brahman, and not this which men follow after here. If you think that you know it well, little indeed do you know the form of the Brahman. That of it which is you, that of it which is in the gods, the shining ones, this you have to think out. I think it known. I think not that I know it well, and yet I know that it is not unknown to me. He of us who knows it knows that. He who knows that it is not unknown to him. He by whom it is not thought out has the thought of it. He by whom it is thought out knows it not. It is unknown to the discernment of those who discern of it, by those who seek not to discern of it, it is discerned. So, identifying yourself with the agency of mind leads you into an incomplete identification with the whole. It is not an object to be known. You can become it. Do you therefore, by that identification, become the infinite? You become one with the infinite. It is not your possession. You are always its aspect, its portion, its amsha. Enlightened you may be, but fortunately in that enlightenment, ego is diminished and eventually extirpated. Well, so again, all other things can then be known in their truth and no longer as now, only in their appearance. It is evident that however much we may analyze the physical and sensible, we cannot by that means arrive at the knowledge of the self or of ourselves or of that which we call God. The telescope, the microscope, the scalpel, the retort and alembic cannot go beyond the physical, although they may arrive at subtler and subtler truths about the physical. So we can't measure it out. We can't cut it into pieces and study it and understand it. The retort and alembic, by the way, these are tools of distillation, which may have originated with Jabir ibn Hayyan in Sufi-based alchemy, who was one of the great mystics in the Shia branch, of course, more than a millennium ago, essentially forming that which could derive from organic materials, the inorganic, or from combinations of things, an essence, a distillation. Literally, it was a still, a kind of small still. Look it up. Interesting to see it. Interesting that Sri Aurobindo would use it here. If then we confine ourselves to what the senses and their physical aids reveal to us, and refuse from the beginning to admit any other reality or any other means of knowledge, we are obliged to conclude that nothing is real except the physical, and that there is no self in us or in the universe, no God within and without, no ourselves even, except this aggregate of brain, nerves, and body. But this we are only obliged to conclude because we have assumed it firmly from the beginning, and therefore cannot but circle round to our original assumption. And this is true, too, if you accept the premises that Shankara offers in the beginning of his examination of the nature of being, then you are bound to his conclusions. If you challenge the premises, then you are not bound to the conclusions. Sri Aurobindo does not accept the criteria by which the mind determines to measure out the universe and its reality, and hence its value. If then there is a self, a reality not obvious to the senses, it must be by other means than those of physical science that it is to be sought and known. The intellect is not that means. We know Sri Aurobindo has stated quite clearly in his Life Divine that the mind has a role to play. Ratiocination has a subsidiary role in the development of a real knowledge, but ultimately it is consciousness penetrating the object of its study and interest. It is a knowledge by identity, of soul suffusing itself into the thing that it seeks, of self finding same self in other self, that is reality. That ultimately is the judge in the case, nothing less. So it is contingent upon the seeker to grow into greater and greater states of self-awareness, to know where we have not shed limiting ignorance, to see beyond our farthest sight and discover yet more vistas to explore, to never be content. Sadhana has no end, and knowledge, only when it becomes essential, can be secure. Undoubtedly, he writes, there are a number of suprasensuous truths at which the intellect is able to arrive in its own manner, in which it is able to perceive and state as intellectual conceptions. So in other words, beyond the measurement of the senses, what can we learn about the inner workings of the cosmos? The very idea of force, for instance, on which science so much insists, is a conception, a truth at which the intellect alone can arrive by going beyond its data. For we do not sense this universal force, but only its results. And the force itself we infer as a necessary cause of these results. So also, the intellect, by following a certain line of rigorous analysis, can arrive at the intellectual conception and the intellectual conviction of the self, and this conviction can be very real, very luminous, very potent as the beginning of other and greater things. Still, in itself, intellectual analysis can only lead to an arrangement of clear conceptions, perhaps to a right arrangement of true conceptions. But this is not the knowledge aimed at by yoga. Again, this is aparavidya, the lower knowledge. We are aiming at the higher knowledge, paravidya. For it is not in itself an effective knowledge. A man may be perfect in it, and yet be precisely what he was before, except in the mere fact of the greater intellectual illumination, an effective knowledge, where power and knowledge become one, where they are reunified. And where does that happen? In chit shakti, in the higher realm, beyond the realm of the mind. The change of our being at which yoga aims may not at all take place if we rested content with that. We are looking for that which shines by its own light, the nature of the Atman, self-illuminating, self-empowering, so that Atma Shakti creates what it sees. It is true that intellectual deliberation and right discrimination are an important part of the yoga of knowledge, but their object is rather to remove a difficulty than to arrive at the final and positive result of this path. This belongs to the range of intellection. So, vitarka, vichara, viveka, all the important V's, you know, for deliberation, for concentration, separation of one from the other, discrimination between the true and the false, all of these things have a level of training to the consciousness which might be indispensable, but they are not themselves the penetration of subject into object, which results in knowledge by identity. Our ordinary intellectual notions are a stumbling block in the way of knowledge, for they are governed by the error of the senses, and they found themselves on the notion that matter and body are the reality, that life and force are the reality, that passion and emotion, thought and sense are the reality. And with these things, we identify ourselves. And because we identify ourselves with these things, we cannot get back to the real self. Therefore, it is necessary for the seeker of knowledge to remove this stumbling block and to get right notions about himself and the world. For how shall we pursue by knowledge the real self if we have no notion of what it is and are on the contrary burdened with ideas quite opposite to the truth? So this kind of discrimination, this kind of philosophic distance that we place between the one who watches and that thing which is watched is a prep school. It gets us ready for that deeper knowledge. Therefore, right thought is a necessary preliminary, and once the habit of right thought is established, free from sense error and desire and old association and intellectual prejudgment, the understanding becomes purified and offers no serious obstacle to the farther process of knowledge. Still, right thought only becomes effective when in the purified understanding it is followed by other operations, by vision, by experience, by realization. So first comes that in-look. Then comes the absorption into the experience. And then comes the never movement out of the experience as it becomes a state of realization. So the purified understanding of the level of the buddhi, if we're thinking in terms of the Sankhian scheme of cosmos, where buddhi is the pinnacle of what is possible as one is engrossed in nature, then there one rests as one gets ready for that leap into the witness consciousness, the true status of the Purusha, which watches all, is unattached to all, is free from that false identity with nature, and there one has liberation. Sri Aurobindo will, of course, describe liberation in a very different sense and has already described the oneness of the knowledge that is really sought. But this is a preliminary step that is often necessary to the seeker after knowledge. A yoga of integral knowledge may have to use this means. If the sahaja experience does not spontaneously reveal the one who is everywhere, then one may have to grow step by step and distinguish among these various steps of nature as being not me, not me, not me, until finally you find the me. I think it's a good place to stop. So we'll put a bookmark there and we'll take up the rest of the chapter next time we meet. The status of knowledge. So if you have a moment, we can read a passage from Savitri. These lines are in the early pages. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 3, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. Begin on page 36. At last was one a firm spiritual poise, a constant lodging in the eternal's realm, a safety in the silence and the ray, a settlement in the immutable. His heights of being lived in the still self. His mind could rest on a supernal ground and look down on the magic and the play, where the godchild lies on the lap of night and dawn, and the everlasting puts on time's disguise. To the still heights and to the troubled depths, his equal spirit gave its vast assent. A poised serenity of tranquil strength, a wide, unshaken look on time's unrest, faced all experience with unaltered peace. Indifferent to the sorrow and delight, untempted by the marvel and the call, immobile it beheld the flux of things. Calm and apart supported all that is. His spirit's stillness helped the toiling world. Inspired by silence and the closed eyes' sight, his force could work with a new luminous art on the crude material from which all is made, and the refusal of inertia's mass, and the gray front of the world's ignorance, and nescient matter, and the huge error of life. As a sculptor chisels a deity out of stone, he slowly chipped off the dark envelope, line of defense of nature's ignorance, the illusion and mystery of the inconscient, in whose black pall the eternal wraps his head, that he may act unknown in cosmic time. A splendor of self-creation from the peaks, a transfiguration in the mystic depths, A happier cosmic working could begin and fashion the world shape in him anew. God found in nature, nature fulfilled in God. Already in him was seen that task of power. Life made its home on the high tops of self. His soul, mind, heart became a single sun. Only life's lower reaches remained dim. But there, too, in the uncertain shadow of life, there was a labor and a fiery breath. The ambiguous cowled celestial puissance worked, watched by the inner witness's moveless peace. Even on the struggling nature left below, strong periods of illumination came. Lightnings of glory after glory burned. Experience was a tale of blaze and fire. Air rippled round the argosies of the gods. Strange riches sailed to him from the unseen. Splendors of insight filled the blank of thought. Knowledge spoke to the inconscient stillnesses. Rivers poured down of bliss and luminous force. Visits of beauty, storm sweeps of delight, rained from the all-powerful mystery above. Thence stooped the eagles of omniscience. A dense veil was rent, a mighty whisper heard, repeated in the privacy of his soul, a wisdom cry from rapt transcendences sang on the mountains of an unseen world. The voices that an inner listening hears conveyed to him their prophet utterances, and flame-wrapped outbursts of the immortal word and flashes of an occult revealing light approached him from the unreachable secrecy. An inspired knowledge sat enthroned within, whose seconds illumined more than reason's years. An ictus of revealing luster fell, as if a pointing accent upon truth, and like a sky flare showing all the ground, a swift intuitive discernment shone. One glance could separate the true and false, or raise its rapid torch fire in the dark to check the claimants crowding through mind's gates, covered by the forged signatures of the gods, detect the magic bride in her disguise, or scan the apparent face of thought and life. So, today is the 14th of June, 2020. 102 years ago, Sri Impi Pandit took birth in Karnataka, came to Pondicherry, went from Pondicherry into the world, became himself a universal spirit moving in time, and a true son of India. Universal in scope he was. So we honor him today and wish a bon fete to all who feel the charge of the felicity that flows on the 14th of June. Much love to you all. Namaste. Jai Ma.